Good evening, I'm Michael Ignatieff, and I welcome you all to this forum on ethnicity sponsored jointly by Oxford University Press, which has put out this Oxford Reader called Ethnicity, edited by John Hutchinson and one of our speakers, Anthony Smith, available in your bookstore at £10.99. The co-sponsor of this event is an extraordinary organization called Darwin at the LSE, a group of social and natural scientists who mounted a series of events that many of you know about at LSE to bring insights of evolution and Darwinian thought to many problems in the social sciences. They combined with Oxford University Press put this together, and it's obvious from the size and of this turnout that we already have a success on our hands. A success that has to be sustained, however, by great acts of discipline and self-restraint on the part of everybody involved. That is, restraint on your part in the sense that this is a public forum in which you're all going to get a chance to talk. But please, for God's sake, keep it short, keep it to the point. Same injunction to our distinguished speakers. They're all under very tough starting orders. If you see me passing nasty notes their way, it's to get them to keep within the 5-minute time limit I've given each of them. The timetable we're looking at is to go through until about 7:10, 7:15 now, because we're starting late, perhaps 7:20. In a first round of discussion on the question, are ethnic ties universal? Then to have a break, come back at around 7:30 and talk about the second half of this question, which is, can they be transcended? I'm chairing both. I think I'm chairing both because I've written about ethnic nationalism myself and because I've traveled in the war zones of ethnic conflict. And it's clear that the reason we are packed into this room in such numbers is more than idle intellectual curiosity. There's something about ethnicity that is alarming and disturbing, both in intellectual terms and moral terms. In fact, it's exceedingly difficult to disentangle intellectual curiosity and moral alarm when the word ethnicity is involved, and we have to do our best to disentangle the moral and the intellectual as best we can. Obviously, the question, are ethnic ties universal, implies, at least in my hearing, another question, is ethnic conflict inevitable? That is, there seems to be some entailment between one question and the other. That's why there's a resonance here, a sense that if ethnic ties are universal, either in a cultural, historical, or sociological sense, or in another sense, in a biological, Darwinian sense, it may be exceedingly difficult for us to create a world in which those ties are not a source of conflict. Now, there's no necessary entailment between the idea that ethnic ties are universal and that they should entail conflict. But that's one of the reasons we're in the room, to investigate that question. And when we talk about universality, as I say, we may be talking we may be giving a historical, sociological, cultural, or possibly a genetic Darwinian evolutionary sense that this is wired into us in some way that we need to understand. And I'd suggest that one of the new elements of the discussion that's entered ethnicity in the last decade has been precisely this Darwinian genetic evolutionary strand of thought, which has a long and, for an intellectual historian, complex history. People have run the line that ethnicity is coded in our genes for a very long time in European culture, sometimes with catastrophic consequences. That is, if you substitute the word race for ethnicity, you can immediately aware that these questions are controversial and difficult, and they have a long history. And the question is, and the question for us is whether the modern scientific understanding of these questions has freed itself from some of the intellectual and moral presuppositions of previous attempts to describe race and ethnicity as genetic universals in ways that, as we know, have difficult human consequences for all of us. So that's the program. Those are the questions that we want to look at in the initial session. And then in the second session, we want to look at whether these ties can be transcended. And by transcended, we mean whether we can live with our differences, whether we can live in peace, whether we can get beyond our original identities to embrace new ones as individuals and as societies. And I'll be interested in introducing that theme in more detail when we return. And now, so that I obey my own injunctions, I wanted to introduce immediately our first speaker, Professor Anthony Smith of this institution. Anybody who works in the field of ethnicity, particularly in the sociology of ethnicity, knows Professor Smith's work. He's in effect going to introduce us to this question. He's going to parse the question, are ethnic ties universal? Professor Smith, all speakers should speak from this platform.
Thank you. I have 5 minutes, so I shall be short. Has there been any period or continent free of ethnic ties? Are ethnic bonds prior, constraining, and overriding? Can sociology explain the nature of ethnic ties? That's how this major question of are ethnic ties is broken down. The short answers, I suppose, are no, no, and I doubt it. Let's start with the first one. Has there been any period or continent free of ethnic ties? When Marxism was alive and well, people always looked for and found the economic last instance. You could always turn up, ultimately, in the final analysis, an economic motive or explanation. It's a bit like that for many people with ethnicity. Of course, it depends on how widely you draw the net of definition of the term ethnicity, which, by the way, is a very new term, and what you mean by a historical period. But in general, there are a few periods, however you define them, where you could not find, if you looked hard enough, some sort of ethnic tie, at least since the beginning of recorded history. That is, we can find proper names of ethnic groups in practically every period and continent, though we might find it difficult to interpret their meaning. And yet, unless you appeal to sociobiology and say that ethnicity is simply an extension of kin groups and is formed by the nepotism of individual genetic reproductive drives, which I would dispute, there's no mechanism which could ensure the necessity or the universality of ethnic ties. I prefer a more cultural approach. For myself, ethnic communities are communities of history and culture linked to a homeland. They do have myths of common ancestry. They claim a shared origin and descent, but these are myths, and we can't know whether these shared beliefs correspond to facts. Very often, they don't correspond to what we know. The early medieval or French, early medieval English or French, can be called ethnic communities, or ethnie, as the French call it, but their lines of descent were very mixed. Gauls, Franks, some Romans in the case of France, Britons, Angles, Saxon Jutes, and some Danes by late Anglo-Saxon England. There's also the well-known example of the Khazars, whom Kessler made famous, the ruling class of a Turkic-speaking people who converted to Judaism in the 8th century. Who knows how many East European Jews were descended from the Khazar nobility rather than Abraham? Nevertheless, this doesn't make ethnies any less real from a subjective standpoint. It suffices that people feel they belong to a distinct cultural community and share myths, symbols, memories, values, and traditions, including myths of descent, for an ethnic community to exist subjectively and therefore have real consequences. And these kinds of community we can find in every period and continent, though I wouldn't want to claim that all human beings were ensconced in such communities. Only that in every period we come across them, and several of them have influenced society and politics in every age, a few of them decisively. Second question. There's nothing prior or overriding, in my view, about ethnic ties. We all have several kinds of social bond, family, religion, gender, class, region, occupation, and so on. At different times, any one of these may predominate, depending on the situation of the individual, and any of these may be perceived as overriding and prior by the individual. And so can ethnic ties be so perceived? They may at times be seen as prior and overriding, and certainly as exercising some kind of constraint over individual actions, but only in certain circumstances, for example, inter-ethnic war. It doesn't follow from this that ethnicity is purely situational and totally malleable or purely optional, or that it depends entirely on the eye and the situation of the beholder. Most of us are born into ethnic communities and have thereby an ascribed status. We need to keep two levels of analysis, the individual and the collective, separate, and not read off individual characteristics from collective ones, or vice versa. Ethnic collectivities are, if not transhistorical, at least intergenerational. They existed before, they continue after us. They're demarcated and known by various traditions and symbols, including language, dress, music, art, food, customs, rituals, and so on. And they're often also carried by certain kinds of institutions, such as churches and liturgies or dynasties. So, ethnicity has been and is important in public as well as in private life. It can and it has shaped society at all periods. It has influenced politics and it causes and it can cause conflict in every period. But it is only one of the historically persistent cleavages and forms of community in the world. Finally, sociology is no more privileged to explain the power and persistence of ethnic ties than other disciplines. Ethnicity is a subject that, in my view, requires a multidisciplinary approach and a long-term historical perspective, what the French call la longue durée. To date, sadly, the rivalry of approaches and paradigms in this field, as in the cognate one of nationalism, suggests that we're still very far from any consensus in our definitions of the key terms, let alone in our explanations. However, given the immense social and political importance of ethnic ties in the modern age, to which Michael alluded, as I may say in pre-modern ages, we must all continue our search for more convincing and more widely accepted explanations. I hope I've stayed in time.
Well, I hope this good example proves contagious. Thank Professor Smith both for brevity and lucidity, and would, in passing, just underline one fact which seems to redouble the complexity of this subject. I'm willing to stand corrected in an academic gathering, but my understanding of the etymology or the origins of ethnicity as a word is that it enters the OED in about 1952. That is, it's a very, in its modern usage, it's an extremely recent usage, and appears to me to be an attempt to find a more acceptable word substitute for race. So the whole world itself can't be taken for granted as if it existed permanently in our historical understandings. Its usage is recent and distinct and historical. We now want to hear from Professor Michael Banton, an emeritus professor at Bristol University. He said rather tartly to me that their emeritus professors are a dime a dozen, but not everyone is chairman of the UN Committee on the Abolition of Discrimination, which is his current post, if I described it correctly, and he will address the same questions.
The seminar is founded on two inappropriate metaphors. There are no ethnic ties, and I don't think it makes very much sense to talk about the transcending of such relations as those we're concerned with. What happens is that children are taught to identify with certain others, kin, members of the local community, sometimes members of a larger group. They are taught preferences to associate with these people with whom that they can identify. And preferences are always exercised at a price. They will exercise this preference for association when it is not too costly. And the preference can be overcome by threat, as we have seen, or these preferences which admit of associations with people whom you like but are not co-ethnics can be overcome by threat, as we've seen in Bosnia. And ideas about discrimination, about avoiding association with people who are not within the magic circle, they can have their prices altered by legislation against discrimination. Now, I agree with Professor Smith about the way that one can identify communities which are normally known by proper names. The people who belong to these communities call them by proper names, which may have a national or a religious tinge to them. And that we in our generation now sometimes say that they have an ethnic dimension as well as certain other dimensions. The word ethnic came in this way in 1935 in the book We Europeans by Huxley and Haddon, which, as Michael Ignatieff said, was to promote it as an alternative to race. And at the end of the 1930s, it was also starting to be used in the United States in a rather different sense, to denote what are sometimes called hyphenates, Irish Americans, Italian Americans, Greek Americans, and so. And that's the way in which Roy Warner was using it in publications from 1944 onwards. So this idea that there is an ethnicity is a characteristic of the consciousness of our own generation. And I believe that whereas it is perfectly possible to read this back into earlier generations, as Professor Smith does, one needs to be very careful about this, because it runs into difficulties if you are to differentiate this dimension from others when the people themselves do not so differentiate it. So that where I would differ from Professor Smith in my prescription as to how sociology must respond to these problems, to acquire new knowledge about these relations, is that I would want to start at the micro level and do the kind of research which focuses on the individuals, finds out what their preferences are for association with co-ethnics, and whether they will recognize trade-offs between those preferences and other trade-offs that they hold. So that from my point of view, it's rather than asking whether these ties can be transcended, it might be better to ask if they can be bought off.
As you can tell, there's clearly something emerging here which we're going to argue about. And I'm very grateful to Michael Banton for making the disagreement between his position and Professor Smith's as clear as possible. I alluded at the beginning to the sense that the question, are ethnic ties universal, has been transformed in the last decade or 15 years by the emergence of evolutionary perspectives, Darwinian, biological, genetic perspectives on this question and to discuss those, we have Marek Cohn, whose book, The Race Gallery, The Myth of Racial Science, I commend to you all. Marek Cohn.
Despite the trenchant assertions, such as the ones that we've just heard, I find that the idea of innate ethnic sense is very, very pervasive. It does seem that in the world we inhabit, and not just the world of backward Balkan peasants, the world of uneducated Westerners, but right across our society, people seem to have the feeling that in some sense, racism is innate, the ethnic sense is innate, ethnocentrism is somehow part of our human nature. I believe that's a rather inchoate feeling, partly because people are reluctant to submit it to critical scrutiny. And in fact, the very idea that it is innate actually suggests that one doesn't need to analyse it because it cannot be analysed. It harks back to the old romantic idea of ethnicity, of folk, of race, as something primordial, something ineffable. What I want to very, very briefly talk about is the question of whether evolutionary perspectives can do something useful to, if you like, unpack the notion of ethnicity, to shed some light on it, to use the toolbox of modern evolutionary theory, which I believe now contains some pretty sophisticated kit, to build a model rather than simply relegating the question of the origins of ethnicity to the myths of time. As it happens, modern Darwinism doesn't really seem to have any very strong convictions on this question. The idea that one can have a genuine, if you like, Darwinian affiliation with people that one shares an ethnic identity with, because they're that bit more closely related to us than members of another labelled ethnic group, is one which appeals to some Darwinian theorists. They think that it goes out like the layers of an onion. We feel very closely bonded to our immediate kin, and then a little bit less to more distant kin, and so on and so forth. Many other Darwinians find this an unconvincing proposition, as I might say. I do. They consider that when you get beyond very close relatives, the effects are pretty negligible. And that debate has been puttering on within evolutionary theory without really going anywhere for some time. But that doesn't actually exhaust the possibilities of a Darwinian evolutionary perspective on ethnicity. Another one lies in working back through our evolutionary history. One very persuasive line of argument, though it's not necessarily a cut and dried or universally accepted one, is that the last common ancestor of chimpanzees and humans was, in effect, a chimp in its social structure and probably in its appearance as well. The biological anthropologists Robert Foley and Phyllis Lee have argued that early hominids lived in conditions which would have selected for just such a chimpanzee-like social structure, actually very unusual in primates. The underlying principle that they're working on is the core prime mover of modern Darwinism, the idea that different sexes have different reproductive interests. The key to male reproductive success lies principally in the access of males to females, whereas the interests of females lies more in gaining access to the resources that are necessary to raise the offspring to maturity and thereby to continue to the next generation. So our ancestors at the time of the split from the ape line were adapting to what's called a mosaic environment, one which was drying out. It was patchy woodland and grassland in between. In that kind of an environment, resources are patchily distributed, so you can only have one female chimp in each clump, so to speak, unlike a forest where gorillas can roam around deriving nutrition and other resources fairly evenly from the environment. For the males, it would have been in their mutual interest for related groups to form bands, coalitions, aimed at defending the territories occupied by these females against incursions from others. That's just how the calculations work out. And because once you enter a certain social system as a species, it can be actually rather difficult to get out of it, because moving involves becoming less fit if you go in certain directions. The argument is that our lineage has conserved that male bonded line. It sounds esoteric, but for some people, some sociobiological popularizers and academic theorists, this image of mutually hostile male groups fighting over turf has an enormous appeal, and the assumption is made that this is something that could be equated with an ethnic group. Of course, a chimp coalition isn't an ethnic group. This doesn't prove that ethnicity as an ethnic sense is part of our evolved nature. The difference lies in the ability to conceive of a group. A male chimpanzee sees another troop coming. He must be able to think the chimp equivalent of here come enemies. He must be able to say, my friend, my foe. What he can't do is think something like, here comes the green banana troop, or here comes the tall tree gang, because chimpanzees don't use symbols to denote either personal or group identity. They can't reify their coalitions as entities with existences independent of themselves. That is the uniquely human capability. That is what induces a man to lay down his life, not for the requisite number of close relatives, J.G.S. Haldane calculated it, of course, as three brothers or nine cousins, but instead to lay down his life for his country. So we can start off from biology 3 or 4 million years ago and end up looking at culture. I believe that this is a useful constructive approach. To justify this, I have to anticipate the second question of the night, maybe because I don't get back in the second round guaranteed. If we are considering how to reduce the conflicts caused by ethnicity, this account takes us from biology and points us very, very firmly at the symbols. Humans have another biological capacity which appears to be adapted, the cognitive capacity to hold several images in mind at once and thereby not just think of one identity, I'm a member of this chimp group, but to adhere to several identities, several abstractions at once, town, religious denomination, ethnic group, class, football team, family, and so on. So promoting some of these and downplaying others may reduce conflict, as supporters of what's known as the European idea believe. To back them up, there seems little evolutionary reason to suppose that ethnic groups enjoy an innate privilege over other group identities and their hold over people's imaginations. And I'd just like to finish by noting that there is likewise no reason to assume that evolutionary perspectives can only lead to pessimistic conclusions about social phenomena. There is an idea abroad that the social value of Darwinism, its application, is to specify limits on social possibilities. And I think that this example of ethnicity shows that Darwinism could also be used to place limits on pessimistic claims about human nature.
I should at this point repair one oversight of mine at the beginning, which was to tell you what you may already know, which is that that great institution, the BBC World Service, is, as it were, hanging over the balcony above, recording our every word for diffusion to millions of our fellow human beings. So we really ought to watch what we're saying in this room, be jolly careful. These microphones should be an injunction on them, self-discipline and awareness of how words can be construed in other places and contexts. What we now want to do, I think, is rather briefly have the panel react to each other. and then open it out to the floor after about 10 minutes so that you don't hear too much from this side and gather frustrations on the other side. It does seem to me, however, that there are some very, very sharp differences here, which are perhaps obvious to you, between an emphasis on common myths of origin, on shared tradition, which you hear very strongly in Anthony Smith's talk, to Michael Banton's very intransigent insistence that we should focus on the associative, or the logic of associative choice by individuals, that we have to look at how individuals choose, discard, adopt, reject certain associative possibilities with other kin and ally or disally with their ethnic ties. I think we also have to factor in the sense that while Darwinian possibilities don't predispose us to aggressive or male chimp-like behavior, there may be in some way that we need to specify pre-rational and pre-symbolic reflexes that can be triggered by our associative choices and our group behaviors. Even if one takes the point, which I think one should take very strongly, that we are symbolic animals, and that distinguishes us from the kind of analogies that limits the kind of analogies we can draw back to animal behavior, we are also animals. And everybody who's been in situations of ethnic war believes that one is in situations where sometimes analogies to animal behavior seem disturbingly pertinent. I want to reintroduce that so that we don't end up with an entirely sanitized view of ethnicity. There may be real savagery here which we have to address, and whether we address it through the genetic route or the cultural or the sociological route, I do want to keep our minds firmly focused on savagery. I wonder whether any of our panel want to intervene directly at this point. Professor Smith.
Well, I can find myself, if not in agreement, at your age, quite able to accept Michael Banton's emphasis on micro-sociology, the micro-sociology of rational preferences by individuals. The one problem I think that's posed by this is the question of passion. Your question, you call it savagery, if you like. If it is only a question of rational preferences, why is it that very often we do find groups of human beings rallying to certain kinds of banners and being prepared to risk lives, theirs and other people's, in the process, and indeed to lay down lives in millions? And this is one of the fundamental questions we certainly have to address. But I'm not sure that I would wish to go down the Darwinian or any other sociobiological route in this way. It doesn't seem to me that we can make the leap from basic analogies, if you like, with animal behavior to the human propensity to respond to symbols. It's that leap in the argument that I find difficult to sustain. This seems to me something purely human, that we identify with certain kinds of symbols, certain kinds of symbols which stand for abstract communities. After all, in a way, there is something fairly abstract about a large ethnic group. If you think of, I don't know, what is it, 8 million Igbo or something as an ethnic group, this is clearly not a kin group. It can't be reduced to a chimp-like behavior. It seems to me that's going too far. And therefore, we have to find why it is that human beings are prepared to act on behalf of the Igbo, let's say, in the Nigerian Civil War, through symbolic devices, and react passionately, too, as well. So these two things, and that's why, for better or worse, I talk of a cultural approach which does emphasize these symbolic attitudes. Of course, one could go into far more detail about the factors that give rise to ethnic groups. I obviously didn't have time for any of that, but if once in existence, and once they are models, and once the idea of being, let's call it a chosen people even, some idea of chosenness, some mission that is entailed in this, by belonging to this ethnic group, takes hold in parts of the world, then it has an effect, which an amplifying effect on others, and a sort of demonstrative effect, and therefore at that point we are talking about responses to symbols, often quite religious symbols, national symbols, as you said.
I'm wondering whether Michael Bantam wants to respond to the point about passion and symbolic action, and how you reconcile that with a kind of rational choice approach to these questions.
I didn't introduce the word rational. And when Professor Smith speaks of rational preferences, he is limiting it. I mean, his conception of rational preferences is a subset of a larger category of preferences. I would be quite content to equate preferences with what the economists call tastes. And there are all sorts of tastes. Some of them are passions. I want those included within my scheme too, and I want to work up from the micro to the phenomena of group behavior and reaction that he describes. It's a big task, but I think we can aspire to show how these larger phenomena are constructed from interpersonal relations.
I'm wondering, just to follow that point, whether there's a moral consequence of your position. Because the stress on individual choice here, however construed, seems to put at the center the sense in which ethnicity is also a set of moral choices. The extent and degree to which you identify with ethnicity, the extent and degree to which you discriminate against other ethnicities. And therefore, you're developing an analysis of ethnicity which supports certain ethical conclusions.
I think that is probably the case. Sociology students all learn what Durkheim had to say about crime as a normal social phenomenon. And I believe that discrimination is a normal social phenomenon in the same sense, and that individuals who discriminate must be held accountable for it. It is a moral dimension to the choices that they take. And I deprecate the way in which people sometimes talk of ethnic movements and of racism as if this is something so much above the ordinary individual that it absolves the individual from responsibility.
Before I bring in Marek Khan, I'm just wondering whether Brendan O'Leary, sitting keeping his counsel, wants to come in at this stage or wants to wait until...
Well, as a partially rational agent, I'm trying to maximize my time later on. I just think that we've seen two discourses. Professor Bantam's discourse comes from the utopia of utilitaria, in which individuals are forward-looking and rational. Professor Smith's comes from the world of the utopia of bigotaria, in which people are obsessed with their pasts. I think both perspectives are useful. If I'm forced to take sides, I think bigotaria is more prevalent and more widespread than Professor Bantam's worldview is capable of recognizing.
Well, the question's pretty obvious, really. Marek, bigotaria or utilitaria? Where do you come from?
I live in hope, but I actually wanted to say something about passions, which is that there is a way of reconciling passions and reason, and that's captured in what I think is one of the best book titles in recent years, Robert Frank's Passions Within Reason, where he points out that actually irrational behaviour may well have better payoffs than rational behaviour. I mean, the crude example is, you know, if you're the sort of person who threatens to break your neighbour's legs for parking in front of your house. This is not a rational act because the costs are so high. You are likely to be thrown in prison. However, if you get a reputation as the kind of person that does that, and you back it up above all with hard to fake gestures like going red in the face and sweating, you know, then you will be able to park outside your house every time you come home. And I mean, obviously, that's, you know, I present this in a light-hearted way, but I think that this can explain a lot of apparent contradictions. Another explanation, which plays a part, now I would not wish to dissent from the idea that I would put it in a way that I would say that actually the ethnic idea has a life of its own, it's actually driving human behaviour rather than the other way around. But I think it's worth remembering that in many situations of conflict, and these are the situations in which ideologies of the warrior have grown up in particular, death was not a certainty. And the likelihood of death in combat may not have been that much higher than the likelihood of an early death in other circumstances. So for somebody to be inculcated with a warrior ideology in which on the surface one believes that one is ready to go to one's death, may actually result in pretty good payoffs for those who survive the risk. Who survive the challenge. In other words, they take the risk and they get enormous benefits in terms of status and, of course, what sociobiologists call reproductive success, or what euphemistically is expressed in the axiom, number the brave deserve the fair. This is stuff that's both evolutionary and also, I think, accords with our own experience.
But the question that follows from Mark, though, is I'm always unclear when I hear that kind of argument or that kind of claim, what kind of view of human agency is implied by those remarks? Because that seems to me to cut through a lot of these questions. I mean, are we the authors of our ethnicity, as it were, of our allegiances? Do we choose them in some sense, or do they speak through us through layers of something that we don't choose? And that's why I find there's a kind of functionalism in the way you talk about these, say, reproductive strategies that leaves me unclear as to what it is that humans are doing as individuals when they make the choices they make, you see?
Certainly, speaking for myself, which ultimately one can only do, I mean, as a highly moral creature, I think that I agree entirely with all the strictures about individual responsibility, but At a general social level, then yes, I have absolutely full confidence that having understood the nature of ethnicity, which may include a biological dimension if you wish it to do so, human groups are collectively able to transcend them.
We've got about 15 minutes now, and we embark on the perilous adventure of participatory democracy here, which may leave you all longing for authoritarianism of some kind. If we could have I think the right thing to do is to have, instead of long and extended comments, short and hopefully cogent questions to panelists would be the best way to proceed. And if you could raise your hands. The other requirement we have is that you could identify yourself by name so that you can be immortalized on the BBC World Service. There are also microphones here, so that if you raise your hand, then wait patiently for someone to stride up with a large object to place in front of your mouth. Who wants to start?
My name is Aidan Hemphill. I just took a book by Gavin and Bethes. And I really agree with Frank Clinton, especially how to distinguish between different forms of this is the delay. And that's how I think we can get the solution to the question of universal time. And I wonder what the panel thinks about this. I think that what's come out of my study of academics is that there's one sort of, or one kind of ethnicity which is very much condemned, which is political ethnicity, by people who are trying to organize state and national level and to modernize that particular country. Whereas that is almost universally condemned, that form of ethnicity seen as causing ethnic conflict. Whereas moral ethnicity, which is something which I see as being imposed from outside of Africa, and aligned to an almost entirely Western agenda of human rights and environmentalism, is something which I think is becoming much more predominant today, much more accepted, and is the vehicle for it being channeled into Africa is through NGO volunteers and various international institutions. And this form of ethnicity, moral ethnicity, is becoming universal, whereas the previous form of ethnicity, political ethnicity, was rather more marginal and political, but was being demonized by its value.
We've, even in the nicest possible way, disobeyed my injunction, which is to address these as questions to specific individuals, but not to reprove you, but hopefully members of the panel will take up the distinction between moral and political ethnicity and toss it back. I think what I'd like to do is continue with a few other, hopefully, questions. Far.
My name is Martin Kerber. I was just thinking, we're a lot of disagreeing people here, and I don't think you'd ever really describe as an ethnic group. But I'd like to know what the panel thinks that it can be while we're in this building for us to use the war. And somehow this building was the only place in which humans in Britain could survive this war. Would, after the war, if we were the only living group of living people still in this country, would we become an ethnic group? And if so, how? Why
and when? I think I'll go on collecting for a minute or two. These questions need more need digestion. A question in the front row here.
Question of religious belief as similar to something in Germany or Paris society, which can override it in some cases. I was thinking, for instance, of the Iranians and Arab nations as having a completely different ethnic background and yet having a strong common religion. On the other hand, religious seem to be something which people are prepared to discard very much more quickly than ethnic.
Front row and then back. Could we identify ourselves, please?
Yeah. I'm asking a question that raise an ethnological problem, because it underlies the premise of this discussion today. Which is this, it goes back to the point that both Michael Gramsci and Michael Banson were making about the relationship between race and ethnicity. In their mind, the ethnicity is in their way race and then the attempt to say the biology ethnicity. The problem with living in the world from a racial point of view, the methodological problem, is the conflation of theories and analysis. That because the world is can be divided into different peoples according to physical characteristics. So this is not characteristic, explain the differences between those people. It seems to me it's the same problem in relation to ethnicity. That just because there is no historical period where one cannot find an ethnic time, the argument memories, therefore, the tendency to form groups must be because of the tendency towards ethnicity. It becomes a circular argument. It seems to me that no government panel has separated the appearance of ethnicity from the extent to explain ethnicity. And unless we separate those two things, the underlying methodological problem, which means that we've never looked at ethnicity in a way other than we've looked at race in the past.
I'm wondering, just to help the panel, whether you could expand on the question slightly. You did it with admirable brevity, but it may be... you may be after something, and we better know what it is. The gender component of ethnic identities.
What's this?
As I say, I think we should keep on collecting.
Yeah.
I'm trying to protect my pal. Is it? I think I'll take one more here. 10 is a perfectly arbitrary number. You may be vibrating with a sense of unfairness, but it's just fate, I have to say. And we will then be able to have 5 or 6 minutes of comment from the panel, and then we'll break. So, question.
Technical reality is quite well. I wonder to what extent how thinking is a difference or making differences between issues of territoriality and issues of ethnicity.
Okay. I don't know how to dish out these various poison chalices that you've also adeptly handed to the panelists. They're excellent questions in the sense that some are about the relationship between religion and ethnicity, some are questions about the relationship between race and ethnicity, between gender and ethnicity, between territoriality and ethnicity, between power and choice, and crucially the issue of language. As themes, that's an extraordinary wide gamut. I'm just wondering who wants to come in. Perhaps they can choose which subject, choose to identify which question or subject they're responding to.
Can I respond to the new kid, age one? I didn't think actually that even if we were here quite a long time, we'd ever form an ethnic group as a result of the fear generated by nuclear war. I think Vandenberg suggested that we had to have three or four generations of endogamy to get to being an ethnic group. That seems a fairly strict criterion, but some kind of firmer interrelationships, I think, would need to develop, both in terms of culture and in terms probably of some kind of physical relationships for that kind of for the kind of agglomeration of people sitting here to turn into an ethnic group. So I, the answer, I think, is no, not because of being incarcerated here for a certain period as an ethnic group. Besides, there is something else. Your question presupposes there's no other living creatures. Ethnic groups stand in relation to each other, and it's a relational concept. So unless we were to find another group incarcerated somewhere else in the world to whom we could oppose ourselves or be related to ourselves, I don't think we would form an ethnic group. So that seems one.
Michael Banton.
I thought Ken and Marek's point was very important, and I wanted to turn it against what you said earlier. When you spoke of savagery and referred to it as being ethnic, we agree about savagery, but what is gained by adding the adjective ethnic? It seems to me that you imply that one knows something more about its nature, you know, by calling it ethnic, and that there is a whole argument here that needs to be brought out and examined, you know, stage by stage. I thought Mr. Campbell could have answered Mr. Kovac's question about how quickly ethnic groups form, because some have formed quite quickly in Africa. You'll find Donald Horowitz's chapter in the Glazer and Moynihan book reviewing some. The Mohajirs, which have formed in Pakistan since 1948, are another example, much shorter time period than Vandenberg allows for. And then, coming back to a whole series of questions about the characteristics of the sorts of communities that get called ethnic, I believe that Anthony Smith and I are in complete agreement with this, about this, that you get communities, as he said, you know, designated by proper names, which have multiple dimensions. They may be religious, and religion may be mixed up with ethnicity, as with Jews and Copts and Sikhs. They may have a territorial aspect to them that may be very important to that group's identity if they're involved in territorial conflict. Language may be of special significance when it comes to encounters with non-belongers to the group. There are other dimensions like this. And here we come back to gender. You see, there had been an attempt in some of the United Nations bodies with which I'm involved to say you must stress the gender dimension. And this view has also been put to my Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. And our view is that if there is discrimination, let us say between a man and a woman, and the man and the woman are of a different ethnicity, then you have to examine the nature of the unequal treatment and to see whether it can be attributed to either the ethnic source or the gender source, or possibly to both. But you have to examine each one each separately to look at the cause of the inequality of treatment, not to try to mould the two together. And that is why I believe that the concept of discrimination is of fundamental importance to our discussion of ethnicity. Thank you.
In a moment. Sorry.
More easily distinguished. actually, on Kenan's point about the term ethnicity, I did wish to go on from that, to note the way that the adoption of the term ethnic as a substitute for race has actually resulted in reaffirming the idea of race by accident. Because people talk about race or ethnicity, by which they actually mean the difference between ethnic groups who look visibly different and those which can't be distinguished by visual inspection. And I certainly see this as a case of race being the repressed that keeps returning, and I think it's a demonstration of how poorly thought out people's ideas of human difference are, and certainly how ineffectual the idea of a substitution with the term ethnic has been. On the nuclear question, I imagine that what would happen is that we would become like one of those many groups which calls itself in its own language the people, or the people of the people, because of course we wouldn't know that there are any other people after a few generations and we'd lost our cultural heritage. You know, we, the Lord of the Flies, we recompose our culture to erase our differences. We would also, I would just note in passing, not have a flag. I think the territoriality question was sort of lobbed more in my court than anybody else's, and actually I'm quite surprised that Stephen Shenner did that, because he's actually better qualified than anybody else in the room, particularly me, to archaeological record. Traces of ethnicity, of ethnic identity emerge, and actually I was really rather hoping that Stephen would tell us that at some stage in the proceedings.
Quick comment.
On the post-Holocaust scenario, I think we divide quite quickly into groups based on our different theories of the causes of the war. In one corner there would be a patriarch. The patriarch would be Professor Michael Banton. He would lead the individualists and the utilitarians into one corner. Professor Smith would lead the bigotarians into another corner. I would contest the leadership of the bigotarians with Professor Smith. Gradually we would form into different cultural groups.
I'm over there with the chips.
There'd doubtless be a separate communitarian group. I'd like to, in response to a series of jumbo questions, give a jumbo answer. God is innocent because he doesn't exist. God is innocent of causing ethnic conflict. Generally speaking, the religious marker is just that, a marker. And you're correct that it's the ethnic which triumphs over religion in most cases, particularly in the case of Islam and Christianity. Elites are no more to blame than masses. Elites grow up with the masses, respond to the same symbolic cues. They may take advantage of them, but they're tapping sentiments that the elites and the mass both share. Territoriality, I'm quite confident, is not very much use to us, because the largest territorial units were built in empires of agraria, which were multi-ethnic in character by and large. The reason why modern borders tend to correspond with culturally homogeneous spaces is for the reason emphasized by Ernest Gellner, which is a way of answering the question about language. Gellner's argument is that because industria requires people to be co-cultural, that creates very strong incentives for people to become co-cultural. Their identities become attached to it, and consequently both their interests and passions become attached to it. So I think language is very important. As for the book on African ethnicity, I haven't read it, but I don't believe in it. There are ethnic groups in Africa. There is no such thing as African ethnicity, just as there's no such thing as Asian or European ethnicity. There is ethnicity, I believe, in contradistinction to Professor Banton.
Thank you.
We're coming to what I think is intended as a brief break where we have a stretch and come back and ask the question about whether ethnic ties can be transcended. I would just like to add one small note of my own to this question, which is the sense that when I have worked on ethnicity myself in Yugoslavia, I've been very struck by the profound moral investment I have in demonstrating that ethnic ties are malleable, fluid, relational, and can be transcended. I'm very struck by the ways in which, despite my best interests, or despite my best intentions, the kind of descriptive sociology I do on the ground is powerfully freighted by the ethical desire to believe that people are not imprisoned by their ethnicities. This is a subject in which it's unusually difficult, I think, particularly in the modern period in which we all, if we believe anything, we believe we are what we have made ourselves. We believe, I think, many of us, that we have made ourselves, that we are our own creation in some sense, that fate has not marked who we are. We're very much more committed ethically to a certain idea of the self than we often realize. And that, I think, flows through everything that we say about this question, or certainly flows through everything I say about it. I'm very struck by the extreme difficulty we have in disentangling our acute ethical interest in getting a certain answer to the question we pose. But we'll return to that question after a 10-minute break. Please return after the break. We're now turning to the question of whether ethnic ties can be transcended. And we might mean a range of things by that. Transcended in the sense of transcended by good politics, by kind of civic forms of constitutionalism that create conditions of civil peace in which ethnicity ceases to be the salient mobilizer of community passions. We might, in other words, imagine ethnic ties being transcended by certain kinds of good politics. What kind of good politics is then the question we have to ask. We might mean transcended in a much more intimate sense as well in terms of identity. That is, the idea that which Professor Smith has put out for us and which is in some sense axiomatic in our self-understandings, that we are layered creatures, that we have many identities, many inherited ties of family, of religion, of race, in quotation marks, class identities. It's fascinating to me the ways in which class identities, which were so salient 25 years ago in a room like this, now seem to have almost vanished from the room, but they've certainly been transcended in very peculiar ways. But the idea, possibly, that we could be, as individuals, as selves, freed from the prison house of ethnic identity. I'm always struck by the very marvelous remark made by a Croatian writer who had been in the opposition in Croatia through 90 and 91, and when the Serbian-dominated JNA crossed the Danube and her country came under attack, what she experienced was the prison house of ethnic identity. Suddenly, she couldn't be a woman, a writer, a mother, a dissident, any number of the other possible identities, Catholic, any of the other possible identities that she wanted to be. She could only be Croatian for an awful 6 months. And that was, she had a sense suddenly that her ethnicity had become a fate that she couldn't escape, couldn't transcend. So the question of transcendence is therefore a political question. That is, are there political arrangements in societies that allow people to move easily between their identities, that allow societies to mitigate, moderate, adjust and conciliate ethnic identity? And then there's a question very intimately directed to ourselves, the sense in which we can rise above, be something more than our ethnic identities. That's how I would parse these questions. And to parse them further, we have Brendan O'Leary of the LSE, co-author of Explaining Northern Ireland. And
with all due respect to my distinguished colleagues, the question posed to us in this section is, I think, more important, at least more politically important, than the one posed in the first section. Like some ethnic leaders and like some ethnic groups, I get my excuses and my revenge in first. So the question is, can we transcend ethnic ties? To transcend has two meanings. One is to go beyond human experience. This kind of transcendence immediately conjures up pictures of God, unicorns, and fairies. Believers in God, fairies, and unicorns can believe, and probably do believe, that ethnicity can be transcended because they believe in this kind of transcendence for other phenomena. I have a problem with this kind of transcendence because I believe that believers in God, fairies, and unicorns are all equally, albeit in their diverse and polyethnic and multicultural ways, cognitively challenged. However, I do not think we've been asked to talk about that kind of transcendence here, and if we have, as an atheist, I'm pretty confident that if I fail on my theological beliefs, that God will turn out to be a rather elderly Irishman. He'll turn out to be slightly alcoholic, slightly sexually hypocritical, and redeemed, I think, perhaps by a sense of humour. But to transcend has another meaning. And it is the one I think we're supposed to address. And it is a matter of grave importance. To transcend can mean to surpass, to go beyond, as Michael Ignatieff put it, in this world, in our experience. In this sense, the question might seem obvious and easy to answer. It is possible, indeed, it's a regular occurrence for most of us to surpass ethnicization in everyday life. We do not all universally practice ethnic nepotism or ethnic favoritism. And in some cases, we've deliberately designed political institutions precisely to inhibit these dispositions. In everyday life, I think most of us, for example, would not inquire into where the blood donation came from, or indeed the genes for gene therapy. We'd want to know whether they were healthy and appropriate, rather than whether they were donated by our co-ethnics. But I don't think the question could be answered in such a trivial way. What I think we're being posed is a fundamental question, and the question is, can we transcend the ethnicization of the state, our political life? We know, or at least I would claim we know, that ethnicity in its minimal and essential form, that is a belief that a people share a common ancestry, has been with us across the three ages of humanity. In the first age, in Phrygia, as Ernest Gellner put it, in the age of hunters and gatherers and nomads, we did share a belief in common ancestry. In the second age, the age of Agraria, we did so as well. In the third age, Industria, the age of we moderns, we also generally categorize ourselves as ethnics. Though we know that we may be of mixed vintages, though we know that some are bi-ethnics and some are multi-ethnics, and still others, like Michael Banton, are in denial. So the question we're being asked is whether a fourth age is possible, a post-ethnic age, to go with all the other post-hyphen concepts currently touted by social theorists, think tank pamphleteers, and those who should never get tenure anywhere, anytime. I don't think anyone here can know the answer to the question of whether a fourth age of humanity is imminent or immanent. My guess, and it's only that, is no. There will be no fourth post-ethnic age. My reasons for this guess are threefold. I believe we're still living in early modernity. As an Irishman, you probably expect me to say that. Secondly, I believe that modernity creates strong reasons for ethnicizing politics in exactly the ways that Ernest Gellner and Anthony Smith and others have carefully examined, and in arguments that I largely agree with. And lastly, because I believe postmodernism should be left to wither, bereft of grants or criticism. Given that, And given that that's the nature of my guess, I believe that the big political question that faces us is how we regulate the necessary ethnicization of politics in the modern world. The degree of ethnicization of our politics is fortunately open to a certain degree of positive political shaping, though of course it's also open to malign manipulation. There are many themes we could discuss here, but given the time constraints, I'd like to focus on governmental domestic choices. The lights should fade. I hope wisdom will not fade at the same time. Fundamentally, I would claim governments have two choices, either to eliminate national and ethnic differences or to manage them. If governments seek to eliminate differences, then they must either eliminate the people or the peoples who are the sources of differences. That's the brutal and savage path chosen by genocidal killers and ethnic cleansers. Or they can choose to eliminate the political salience of those differences. If they take the latter, more humane and more desirable choices, then states may choose territorial restructuring. They may permit secession or downsizing. Or indeed they may permit more autonomous home rule institutions, confederal relations for those who demand them. Alternatively, as Michael Ignatieff I think was suggesting, they may favor integration on the basis of equal citizenship, confining ethnicity to the private sector, to the private sphere, encouraging party competition and electoral behavior, which leads to inter-ethnic voting, or what Donald Horowitz calls vote pooling, encouraging a legal, social, and economic order, which treats citizens as individual equals. Lastly, and most ambitiously, they could, of course, go for assimilation, a step beyond integration, a step which is often coercive as well as possibly being voluntary. What's important, I think, for our purposes is to avoid the illusion that assimilation or integration are strategies for transcending ethnicity. They're not. Assimilation almost invariably means assimilation into a dominant ethnic culture. It is not a form of transcendence. Though some step out of their roots, it's only to acquire new ones, sometimes shop-soiled ones. Integration, by contrast, appears more neutral. It separates ethnicity from citizenship, the civic order from ethnic culture and cultures. But its critics rightly argue that the state order cannot be ethnically neutral. It's normally fused with the markers and signifiers of the Staatsvolk, the dominant people. And while strategies of integration may be partially successful with voluntary migrants, willing in principle to shed some of their culture in exchange for citizenship, they are, to my knowledge, always ultimately failures when applied to homeland peoples who dispute the same homeland. The alternative to eliminating differences is to live with them, to manage them. The management of differences, I think, can be basically divided into two categories: the hierarchical category, the strategy of control or domination, and by contrast, the more egalitarian, pluralist, and democratic strategy. Some 900 million people, according to Ted Gurr, live under regimes of control or domination. For us, in contemporary liberal democratic states, I would claim our choices are fairly straightforwardly confined in terms of management, either to federal or consociational strategies, or to combinations of the two. Federal strategies work very well when you can convert a territorially concentrated minority into a territorially concentrated majority by shifting the boundaries of political units. They don't appear to work very well unless you've got those kinds of circumstances. The second set of tools are consociational, recently named, but the phenomena that they describe are well known. Political institutions designed to encourage power sharing, principles of proportionality, communal self-government, and minority veto rights. So to conclude, these, I think, are our domestic choices, the domestic choices of democratic states. We do have choices about how to regulate ethnicities in ways which may be desirable, both for present majorities and for present minorities. We can manage through federal or consociational means, or indeed through combining them. We can alternatively seek to eliminate differences through permitting secession, through redrawing sovereign boundaries, or by promoting integration or assimilation. These are our big domestic options. One warning. In more complicated cases, which I've not discussed, including my own homeland, frontier regions, where ethnic group competition has a national or homeland character, additional arbitration and indeed co-sovereignty devices may be necessary. But let's leave those complications to discussion. It's the task for all of us to decide in our circumstances, in our democracies, which are the best choices for us and for our groups and why. But I think that it is an illusion. I think that it's an illusion to think that we can wholly transcend the ethnicization of politics. I don't think we have that choice. And I can see George Shefflin looking at me, and I hope he disagrees with me because it will be more interesting for you. Thank you.
I want to thank Brendan O'Leary. George Shefflin, also of this school, is going to comment, respond to, react to Brendan's discussion. And then, instead of going to panel discussion, Anthony Smith suggested to me in the break that we should go back to the you, the audience. So that's where we'll go immediately, and then come back to the panel for some concluding thoughts. And we have, by my watch, until about no later than 8:30, something like that.
Sorry to disappoint you, Brendan, but we do actually agree. I do believe that we shall not transcend ethnicity, even if we go into the fairyland, and I also agree with it, there are ways of managing it. But I come at it, I think, from a slightly different perspective. Again, I think I'm stating common ground when I say that we all have ethnicity. The universalist Western state is to some degree ethnicized, but we don't necessarily see it that way. But I would suggest to you that, let us say, the French civic identity is structured by French cognitions and intuitions, so it's the Dutch, so it's the Danish, and so on and so forth. So why is this ethnicization not a problem? And here I would suggest to you that the explanation is that actually we're looking at the wrong problem this evening. It's not ethnicity that's the problem, it's the factors that constrain it, or their absence. Ethnicity is profoundly destructive in the absence of two other vital constraining forces. Citizenship, civil society, I see these two as a single cluster, and the state. The weakness of civil society gives rise to opaque modes of the exercise of power, and the consequent fears on the part of society as to its collective existence, as to its survival as a collectivity, as to its cultural reproduction. Power is opaque, you don't know what's happening around you. The weakness of the state generates bad governance, which then makes predictability and stability very hard to sustain, and civil society cannot function autonomously. There's no proper legal system, for example. I would suggest that the nation, a contested term, whoever there was one these days, is the interactive relationship between state, citizenship, and ethnicity. Each affects the other. Each is an identity-forming process. The problems of ethnicity are salient, therefore, when one or other constraining factor is weak or absent. And if all three are absent, that's not a state that's going to last very long. If you want an example, it's Belarus. You wouldn't put money on Belarus for all. Long. Ethnicity is weak, state is weak, civil society is weak. They want to disappear. Multi-ethnic political systems. These are a real problem of management, and I'm very close to Brendan on this one. I would suggest that, from my analysis, ethnicity is constrained by strong, though ethnic, civil societies, and strong, though non-ethnicized, state. This is essentially Belgium. It does work. Finally, a word, if I may, on my own area of specialization, which is Central and Eastern Europe. And I would suggest that here the central problem, this refers back to many of the things that Michael was saying, the central problem is that the state is weak. the state is very weak, because when communism collapsed, it wasn't just the ideology that disintegrated, but the communist state itself failed. And civil society had already been destroyed by communism. Consequently, they are engaged in a process of reconstruction, which is very difficult, very problematical. And there I'll stop.
We've had two extremely high-powered bits of political science which are treating the question of the transcendence of ethnicity as essentially a political problem. But I said at the beginning that I don't... Sorry? You can't hear. Maybe I'll creep closer. What I was saying was that we've had two excellent discussions of the politics of managing, if not transcending, ethnic conflict. But I don't want to foreclose on other ways in which we might construe the idea of transcendence, because as I said at the outset, this is also a problem for individuals. It's also a problem of culture. It's also a problem of self-identity and belief. Obviously, the framing constraints that political systems create for us largely define the conditions in which it's possible as individuals to transcend ethnicity, or to manage it, or to do something. But let's not forget the individual dimension. Let me then open this up. We will come back to George and Brendan towards the end. Let's go back to Michael Banton for a comment.
I want to comment that all the speakers so far have ignored the international obligations of states. Their obligations under treaties, particularly the UN Human Rights Treaties, the kinds of undertakings concerning minority rights policies that states have had to give in order to get admission to the Council of Europe.
Do you take those international constraints seriously?
If I'd had more than my allotted 6 or 7 minutes, I would have liked to look at our interstate choices. It is true that we have internationally prohibited genocide, I think to little effect. It's true that internationally we have a whole range of desirable instruments for outlawing discrimination, which have been effectively incorporated into many states' jurisdictions in a desirable and effective way. What I think is sadly missing is an agreed intellectual approach, particularly in the West, to appropriate forms of intervention in external ethnic conflicts. The way in which we managed, and I use the we collectively, meaning we, the West, the hegemonic, the powerful, the way we managed our interventions in a whole range of conflicts, particularly the Balkans, but elsewhere, particularly Rwanda, I think are a testimony to the weakness of our capacity for international governance at the moment. But I didn't want to suggest that such mechanisms don't exist. And I thank you for drawing that to our attention.
At the back there. Just wait for the microphone. And again, please identify yourself and be as succinct as possible. I think cosmopolitanism is the privilege of those who have passports. Cosmopolitanism, that is, universal, non-ethnic, transcended identities, are always grounded in entitlements, very specific ones. You can be a cosmopolitan if you have an American passport, or in my case, a Canadian passport. It's very hard to be a cosmopolitan if you are a stateless person, if you are at the mercy of the ethnic tyranny of another group, I just think that the possibility of transcending your own identities does depend crucially on what kind of state you're lucky enough to be born into and what advantages you can derive from that. I think that that's been the historical weakness of cosmopolitan universalism. We're always, it's a form of privilege which we enjoin and recommend to others who often do not enjoy the privileges that are so taken for granted in our own lives as to be entirely invisible. So it's cosmopolitan universalism, a commitment to universal human rights, a feeling that your own state identity is rather weak claim, the sense that your racial identity is rather a weak claim on your identity, all that's possible once you have the privilege of security. That's my point. And the number of human beings who can actually claim that is finite and relatively small to the total global population.
One of the things that I remarked in this watching the benches is that ethnicity is treated essentially like a disease, like a plague. You know, we've heard about this plague sitting under the African galleries and then under the gravel and dust and so on and so forth. I wonder, I mean, we know that ethnicity is often attached to violence, but not always. I think it's important that someone should say that there are positive aspects.
Question there.
My name is Sophie Andrew, and the more I think about this, I think the more I find this a very frustrating discussion, because it seems to me that the way we're using the template is as we go, ethnicity itself is a pretty meaningless category, because all we've discussed tonight and established really is that ethnicity is basically the fact that we identify with some people and not with others. And it's used in a very kind of ahistorical, generalized way, which doesn't really clarify exactly what we're talking about. Least of all, try to be specific about what we're talking about and explain why, in different circumstances, at different times of history, in different circumstances, we identify. So it's almost as if it doesn't really matter if we're in the past with race, there's a biological basis to it. The ethnicity is a new category. It doesn't really matter if it's biology or if it's cultural. This is something that's there and it's there to stay. And then we rapidly started into a discussion of transcendence and what's any kind of material approach. And it seems to me that that's a bit premature to start talking about transcending something that we haven't really described exactly what it means. And we talk about hands being contained already, that it seems to be more talking about anxiety.
Mark Winslow, which I mentioned, science is very unusual in our culture, and speaking frankly of our ways and trauma. And the Oxford University leader ethnicity will probably be much widely read in the UK and the US, where ethnic is generally understood, popularly understood, to be black. We know from genetics that a tiny number of genes determine skin color. I'm interested in what Mel had to say about how questions of colour relate to transcendence, because I think perhaps white people very much want to transcend ethnicity, but black people perhaps first have a need to be recognised and included. And certainly I do notice that most of you all of you are white and most of you are
I actually find this discussion and comments both by Margaret and by the leaders, because it seems to suggest that your cosmopolitanism and ours would transcend ethnic ethnicity and your identities can be quite fluid, whereas those people out there in the market will go on killing each other over the ethnicity seem to be resigned to their situations, and nice people in women have the responsibility to rescue them from their savagery. I mean, how you, are you saying that you're on your duty to rescue these people?
Yes.
First of all, I think it should have been plain from what we said that Michael Ignatieff and Brendan O'Leary have separate identities. Secondly, I think it should be plain that we are both plainly stated that we have national identities, and I think we both explicitly mentioned that we had. I asserted that we all have ethnic identities. I did not claim to be a cosmopolitan. I agree strongly with Michael Ignatieff that cosmopolitanism is the privilege of those with passports in their pockets. I think the speaker, as well as all of us, have a duty to do what we can to prevent ethnic slaughter in Rwanda. And if that makes me an elitist, I'm delighted to be an elitist.
Jack, the question of power has been raised before, Michael said what you mentioned, but it doesn't seem to be addressed. What I don't understand about the discussion so far is we don't seem to address at all the historical and political circumstances, particularly in terms of modern history, which actually is ground for the development of this interest in ethnicity. I realize that there's only one four-letter of synergy with to talk about, and that's Marx, of course. I don't think you should disappear altogether. I think there was an insight that is going to be wrong. But let me just draw attention to the fact that both in Rwanda and in Yugoslavia, there is a massive importance to attach to the modern historical, economic, and social developments which create conditions for power groups, particularly benefit from manipulating the circumstances in which they've done, which is Milosevic, of course. Milosevic's power is presenting himself as a nationalist, but being really a power hunter, not a nationalist at all, as we've seen from his desertion of the service of the Kahina, which he took no interest in when they were claimed by the Croatians. So their power was manipulated and used and deliberately fostered based on Serbian myth, built up as a theory for achieving power. There sure is no question of power has to be addressed. It seems to me that ethnicity is something lying about to be used in certain circumstances by groups which are emerging, which are seeking power. This question surely has to be addressed.
Question.
Yes, so Ben, one thing. I just thought I ought to sort of throw a spanner in the works here. The question, can we transcend ethnic ties, is a very interesting and important one. But I'm wondering perhaps whether it's rather premature. The question seems to assume that we are all agreed upon the meaning of ethnicity, and that we also, in agreeing the meaning of ethnicity, can also demarcate it from other terms with which it's often confused, such as race. And yet, the popular understanding, the popular usage of race and ethnicity suggests to me a confusion and the interchangeability of these two concepts. So, we really shouldn't be trying to grapple with this difficult question of how we transcend ethnicity without first of all understanding what ethnicity actually means, and secondly, how it relates to our concepts of which is confusion, such as race.
I don't know whether... Are you going to activate me here?
I mean, I'm just sitting here, you know, so I couldn't get a seat. You know.
I think because the point is an excellent one, and it threatens to derail the discussion, and because you've written so saliently about how it is that ethnicity as a language has emerged in the post-war world and has this very uneasy relationship with older categories of race, I'm wondering whether you can disentangle the two slightly so that we can avoid the confusions that the speaker has brought up.
Drawing on the earlier confusion, actually, I would like to encourage Chuck Ken and Mallet to comment on this as well. Is that all right? Yeah, no, seriously. In fact, there is a sensible way to do this if Kenan were to talk about the pre-Second World War period, which he's written about extremely lucidly. I mean, the idea that actually races were classes and vice versa.
Which is, how does somebody like Brendan Lear, how would you see the distinction between managing ethnicity and managing inequality? Because I think it's actually there in this question. Because it seems to me that when you talk about a scripture difference, that those differences are very important, very often not freely chosen, but imposed to a large degree through unequal racist other practices. And so, how does one distinguish? Well, when we talk about plural society, what we're talking about is an unequal society. So how does one draw the distinction between managing ethnicity and managing inequality? And are they in fact not the same thing?
They don't have to be the same thing. There's two kinds of management. One kind of management is managing hierarchically, managing unequally. Most of the plural societies in history are, as you say, hierarchical in character. They involve the domination of one ethnic group over another, or a coalition of ethnic groups disorganizing a series of others. Sometimes it's based literally on historic slavery, sometimes it's based on migratory class-based patterns. You can nevertheless have management of ethnic differences based on group equality as well as individual equality. There will nevertheless be class differences in such societies, but if ethnicity and class do not correspond, at least the management leads to equal management of ethnic groups. That is indeed the ideal of consociational systems. In consociational systems, you do have power sharing across all groups. You do have proportional allocation of public sector posts, public sector expenditure to groups on an equal per capita basis. You have community self-government. You have veto rights for minorities. The whole premise of consociational systems, properly conceived, is to ensure equality across groups. You can, of course, standardly the argument, maintain that consociational systems can be argued for by those who want to preserve existing ethnic inequalities. And it's no accident that in the last days of apartheid, reformers in South Africa chose to adopt consociational rhetoric because they thought they could use consociational devices to cement existing racial inequalities. They failed to do so, and I'm delighted that that happened. But just because you want to manage something doesn't mean that you necessarily want to manage it in the hierarchical way. The management of ethnic difference can be done for egalitarian purposes. Many Marxist-Leninist regimes thought that that's what they were doing.
Both are really a question of inequality and not a question of identity.
Always?
If you look at historically, go back to.
Sure, I'm happy to.
The question of the marriage race, if you look historically at the evolution of race within modern European society, race as a concept involves a fundamental contradiction between societies that have a profound belief in equality and the inequality of those societies, and it becomes a way of explaining inequalities in societies which have that fundamental belief in equality. And it's interesting, if you look in the 19th century discussions that race had nothing to do with colour. That the race is often described as class interests, different class of students in the race. So it seems to me that this question about the relationship between managing ethnicity, and I'd argue that much the same is true in managing ethnicity today, which is why a racist question about the relationship between managing ethnicity and managing inequality seems often one and the same thing.
It may often be that that equality may, that equation might sometimes hold. I don't think it holds always. Ethnic difference and ethnic antagonism can occur between equally resourced groups, equally privileged in relationship to the development of the productive forces or whatever language you wish to use. You can, of course, get ethnic relationships and ethnic antagonisms between deeply unequal groups. I don't see why you have to think that ethnicity and race purely arises out of a relationship of inequality. I think what lies behind that is the supposition of old style, give me that good old time socialist religion. Transcend it, comrade, transcend it.
Let's stop that discussion here and move on to other questions in the front row here.
Question, whether we like it or not, theories of personal identity are quite popular and influential. So I would like to ask the panel whether they think about that we have this kind of influence on ethnicity and ethnic type and on the prospect of transcending them. From my work at America, what has emerged is that rather than transcending ethnic types, they're becoming what identity, which is becoming stronger and stronger because of the influence of theory of identity. And that's clearly related to the time of the past, whereas before the political views were in terms of class. Now it's primarily in terms of identity and especially ethnic identity. And this risks ethnicity becoming of the same as race, but it being a very centralist category. So there's definitely a problem there. And related to this, on the question of civil society, as ethnic identity becoming stronger in Latin America, people see this as an indication of a stronger civil society. So it's not always a case of civil society restraining ethnicity. And that's supposed to be because ethnicity isn't always seen as a bad thing, as gentlemen over there at any point.
No, it's over.
I'm here already. I have a question, partially for the chair, but for the whole panel as well. I'm related to this idea that there can be positive aspects to ethnicity. Keeping in mind that I've done my research in Northern Ireland, so I've seen lots of the negative bits as well. Is it absolutely inevitable that ethnicity leads to conflict and violence? Because such a chair is often in those terms, as it is definitely a road in that direction, and there is no alternative. And then perhaps the more positive aspects of ethnicity are irretrievable or not worth trying to preserve because of the example of violence. So my question is that what people of power believe or not?
Just for myself, I want to correct any implication of what I'm saying in loose use of the word savagery, that I believe that conflict is entailed in ethnic identities. Far from it, and it seems obvious to me that we are not disembodied rights-bearing creatures. We come thick with a history, and that history is often the history of our ethnicities. And it seems sociologically and historically naive to suppose that we can ever be other than thickly embodied by our past, our traditions, our loyalties, many of which are focused in our what we call now an ethnic identity. I did want to stress that I think we invent, we create, we project, we imagine our identities. They aren't simply stuff that comes out of it as a kind of biological fate. As to the question of violence,
I'm very struck by my Yugoslav experience simply making it the point over and over and over again. You get ethnic violence when you have bad politics, when you have the collapse of communist states, when you have communism destroying civil society and making it impossible, for example, for ethnic groups to form multi-ethnic, non-confessional political parties, for example. The catastrophe in Bosnia wasn't a catastrophe that sprang from the fact that there was some irrevocable tendency in each of the ethnic groups towards conflict, but that those ethnic groups were unable, for a host of very complex reasons, to form multi-confessional, multi-ethnic political groupings, and to engage in a politics in which ethnicity was not the be-all and end-all of political mobilization. It was politics, not culture, not fate, not biology. And also outside intervention and catastrophic international politics and whatever else you want to throw into. But nothing that simply derives from ethnicity itself that produced that conflict, just to clarify my own view of it. Back row.
My name is Stanley Cook and I work for the Humanitarian Humanity Force and I inspire the camp. Rwanda has been mentioned, I think it's quite a problematic form of ethnicity. Firstly, because I think the language is such an important factor in the shadow problem. And secondly, Greek ones originally there were economic bands. Originally, some of them were in certain camps, which are completely some of them were just in different camps. So it's a bit like you're making the text, but I'm still here. I think one thing can ethnicity really transcend it depends often on the attitude of those discussing ethnicity for like tonight. Looking back on the Rwanda genocide, there was established fairly quickly. Understanding that the way Hutu equates it with the way extremists on America, the way Tutsi equates it with the way victim or killed. This, I don't know if that affected the world's reaction or lack of it to what was happening with San Lazio, where between us and the Pharaoh, between Egyptian and 150,000, Hutu were killed in Eastern Zaire. I think it is important that we're not introducing ourselves a kind of new racial discourse by making such associations. Because then we have many English people who have problems distinguishing between Islamic and Islamic. The press coverage here in the last few days. Just one example of that to finish. How perceptions can differ. Belgium might be cited by one of the panel's excellent example of ethnicity against itself, where it is more or less responsible for the genocide of the language of the politics and what we did here.
I have an impossible task. It's 8:22, I think. It would be good to send us all out into the night for a drink at 8:30, and that means the arbitrariness with which I select people now becomes totally absurd. We need two more contributions, quick and to the point. One here and one there, and that'll be it.
The first is comment, but I want to respond to the woman in the second row who made the assertion that ethnicity or ethnic in the United States means black. I think young people in the United States define that statement very problematic. The second statement I found it curious that she found the ethnic or racial composition of the panel problematic, but she didn't find it problematic that there were only men in the panel. Very interesting. Which, you know, is startling for me. But what keeps resonating for me as I'm sitting here is, on the one hand, we're talking about the dynamism of ethnicity and its evolutionary processes, but yet it's talked about in a a really essentialist way as a fixed categorical construct. And I'm not convinced that we've actually, in order to talk about transcendence, we need to actually talk about it and deconstruct it as a dynamic, not an individual construct.
To echo the comments that we need a set of plans from the floor, I want to stay on the panel. As the panel wants perhaps feel that our ability to transcend ethnicity might be increased if we understood the benefits of ethnicity better.
I think that's a rather good place to stop and to conclude with three very brief comments from the front of the room. Brandon first.
Like many people, believe it or not, I think there are positive functions and benefits from ethnicity. Because I talked about managing it, I talked about eliminating it on the part of governments, didn't mean that I thought it was desirable to eliminate it. You can manage many things which you consider to have Janus-faced qualities. Love has its bad side and its good side, so ethnicity. Above all, ethnicity assists socialization, identity formation, and security. It is when communities are threatened that they feel most likely to engage in violence. I'd like to concur with Michael Ignatieff on the point that it's bad politics, bad political institutions, which create the possibilities for ferocious ethnic mobilization. And a lot of the time, it's insecurity which is played upon. That is not to downplay the significance of phenomena that most of us don't like to talk about, the deliberate mobilization of antagonism for gratifications of various kinds. We were, I think, assailed by large numbers of people in the audience for neglecting power, neglecting history, and for being essentialists. Can I take that in reverse order? I am an essentialist. Ethnicity does have an essential quality. The essential quality is a belief in shared ancestry. Now, of course, it's malleable in some empirical sense because people are going to vary which ancestors they wish to emphasize at different times for different political purposes, but the concept isn't malleable. Power. Of course, ethnicity is invoked by those who use power. So are a whole range of other social phenomena. To reduce the ethnic question to power mongering, to the machinations of elites, is, however, a kind of reductionism which fails to analyze the phenomenon properly. If we do treat ethnicity properly, we'll understand why people can manipulate it. So don't simply decode, deconstruct whatever particular vocabulary you like. The phenomenon is one of being attached to power, although it's important. Historical materialism. Yes, I think if we get rid of Marxist eschatology, Ernest Gellner showed us a way of using historical materialism to understand the changing importance of ethnicity. In the tribal era, there was no state. In consequence, there was no connection between ethnicity and government. In the agrarian era, ethnicity was also decoupled from government, except at the level of the ruling class. It's only in the modern era, where we're co-equal, where we're demotic, if not always democratic, that co-culturalism becomes so important, and the state itself becomes ethnicized. That's why in the contemporary era, for all sorts of good historical materialist reasons, ethnicity acquires a previously unrecognized political importance. I'd like to conclude by saying, as a panelist, what's striking for me about the phenomenon of conferences like this is how ethnicity becomes an occasion for everybody, occasions like this, for an immense amount of moralizing. People stand up to affirm what they think is good and what they think is bad. They use conferences with this title for that purpose. They engage in witnessing a form of identity affirmation. Sometimes that might be useful. I think our duty, at least in the academy, is to understand and to explain, as well as to prescribe.
And to that end, I'd like to conclude on a rather acid note. I don't think postmodernism in any kind assists us in that particular endeavor. Thank you.
Quick comment from Marek and then from George.
The return of the repressive race about halfway through the last session affirms for me the need for us to get to grips with that word. My heart sinks whenever I see scare quotes placed around it in a feeble attempt to distance oneself from the concept. If you cannot write the word race without putting quotation marks around it, you are never going to be able to get to grips with the sometimes difficult, and sometimes actually not nearly so difficult, questions that it raises. We do, I think, evidently have a reservoir of concern, of confusion about the question of biological variation. I think perhaps when references are made to external visible differences of skin colour, perhaps they speak about, you know, could we raise the idea of other forms of difference? But however hard we concentrate, and this would take another seminar at least to clarify those questions, we're still going to escape it because of the great historical shift of the concept of race into not only the word ethnic, but into a different domain. The great transformation when mainstream science gave up on it in horror because of its delegitimizing qualities at the end of the Second World War and allowed a school on the other side of academia to take it over and to assert that only it has anything to say about the concept of ethnicity. We need a bit of both, but the big problems are over in that other one.
George.
I too accept that ethnicity has certain essential qualities in addition to a sense of a shared past. I would also suggest as a very clear sense of a shared future. If a particular group defining itself as an ethnic group doesn't see itself going anywhere, it won't stay for very long, at least not as an ethnic group. The problem of power, particularly in the context of Yugoslavia, it's not enough simply to say Milosevic is a terrible man, he was manipulative, he used power. Why was he able to do this? Why was there resonance? Where were the failures of the Titoist years? Was Yugoslavia a viable state? Was Yugoslavia ever a viable state, first of all, 1st of December 1918? I think there are big question marks. Maybe, I have written about this, that Yugoslavia was a historical error. And it's an argument that one can be, that could be pursued, though not on this occasion. A broader point, if we look at Europe, and all my identities are European ones, so I'm quite Eurocentric on this, it seems to me that there is an argument to be made that the quantity of violence associated with ethnicity in Europe is quite small. We all focus on the pathology of Yugoslavia. Where's the war between Russians and Estonians? Where's the war between Hungarians and Romanians? Where's the war between Flemings and Walloons? And so on and so forth. There will not be a war between Scots and English, or even between Basques and the rest of Spain. It seems to me that in Europe we have evolved instruments, methods for containing the worst of it. It doesn't mean that it's pleasant. There is still a conflict, but the conflict is political rather than military, rather than terroristic. I have one final thought on elitism, cosmopolitanism, and that's to quote an Estonian friend of mine who said, you know, we Estonians, we are ethnic cosmopolitans.
I'd like to draw this forum to a close by thanking the people who organized it, Darwin at LSE and Oxford University Press, and in particular Gay Wolven, who has been circulating around the hall making everything possible. I think we all feel a debt of gratitude to her and to everybody in both of those.